Okay. So why is it that Brock's lament cannot happen? First, now that I've done this, right, nobody else is going to ask a question after class, right? Because that turned into homework, right? Which is, I hope at least it wasn't an unreasonable homework. And this should have, you know, there should have been about 10 minutes of puzzlement and then this should have jumped out of you. So why can't it happen? Brock, I'm sure at this point knows the answer. Why can't it happen? And let me explain, right? When Brock raised the question after class last week, I gave him the wrong answer. I had to go back and look at it too, and partly that's because I wasn't the one who wrote the code, so it wasn't fresh in my head. And the funny part is we had actually talked through the design and converged on the conclusion that it worked, but because I wasn't the guy who implemented it, it wasn't fresh in my head. So why do we not get stuck in this scenario?
What happens when process P2 tries to acquire log L1, it will be continuously in the loop, it will be in the busy state, and till that time process P3 with higher priority than P2 will come and will set the shoot effort flag for the right. Process P2, and when next time the for loop executes, it will check whether the shoot effort flag is set or not, and if it is set, as P3 has already set it, so the transaction will get aborted for the process P2 and it will release all these resources.
Okay. So exactly. So the process that was the problem was the one in the middle. And the reason it's not going to stay stuck is that if it is, so first, the only way it can be not making immediate progress if it's attempting to acquire some kind of a mutex. Right. Otherwise, it's making progress and things are falling. Okay. If it is attempting to acquire a mutex, it is spinning doing that. While it is spinning, it is checking for the flag that says, forget it, pull the ripcord. Okay. So at the risk of imposing some conjecture on what you may have been thinking, Brock, the concern was that perhaps it was sleeping on a queue and therefore not checking, right? That basically often you'll see a more complicated semaphore design, which invariably starts with exactly this kind of mutex at the top, but the behavior, if I can't immediately acquire the mutex, is that I get in line. Get in line means I get on a queue and I get off the processor, right? And if I'm in a queue because I wanted to get off the processor, well, the whole point is I'm not actively checking anything. I'm trying to get off the processor, okay? And if I'm not checking anything, then specifically I'm not checking the flag that says, get out of the way, here comes the train, okay? I'll come back to that in a second. What about spin locks? Why is it okay that this escape hatch is not checked in the spin lock case? Can't block while in a spin lock. Right. Okay, so the rule for a spin lock, this is not a rule that's checkable, and that is, it's not something the code can enforce. We actually can build tools that will help us check this rule. The rule for a spin lock is, if I grab a spin lock, I'm not allowed to do anything that would cause me to delay while I hold the spin lock. So in particular, in abstract, I am not permitted to acquire a mutex if I already hold the spin lock. There is, in fact, in the code, a violation of this statement where we are acquiring a mutex inside a spin lock, but it's a very special case because it's a mutex on an object that we have just created and to which we know we hold exclusive access, and therefore it's not possible that anybody else would hold this mutex. But in the general case, and by the way, I mean that code is ill-behaved, it shouldn't be doing that. But it's not violating the actual requirement, even though it's violating the letter of the rule. But the actual requirement is, thou shalt not block with the spin lock help. And that's even more true for an IRQ lock, right? So that would be great. You'd be blocking with a spin lock held and interrupts disabled. What's the likelihood that you will ever get kicked out of this state? What doesn't run when the interruption is disabled? The scheduler, right? So if you're running with interrupts disabled, the scheduler is unable, at least on your CPU, to schedule anybody else who might kick you in the pants. And by the way, you're not checking for a reason to get out of the way either, because that's a form of a spin lock. IRQ locks are a matter of some delicacy, which is part of why we escalated them into a type of their own, is so that it would be right in your face that you were messing with something tricky. Okay, good. Any questions about that? Yeah.
Flag, which says a source, right? So when I sign a particular sheet, that for the current process, the process is checked.
Whoa! How do we get to process?
If you're setting the shooter for flag on the CPU, and a process that was running on that CPU, and this is the process that comes in.
I don't know what that means. You've already got a scenario that I don't understand.
Set the shooter for flag. Does it mean that it is set for the CPU and the current process that is executing?
It is set. Okay, good. It's a good question. It's a tricky question to frame, and let me try to tease apart why. You're on to a good question. The question is, if I can rephrase it, the should defer flag is, it's a flag in the CPU structure. Does it actually apply to the CPU? Does it apply to the process? Does it apply to some combination of these? And if so, how? Okay. Your intuition is right. It applies to some very odd combination of these. But let me make an observation. The only way that a process can lose a CPU is if it chooses to block. Now, it might be that it's going to block on the ready queue. The ready queue is a very funny kind of a stall queue. It's a funny kind of a blocking, right? You're prepared to run, you're just not running right now. Any process that does that is going to end up internally in its path calling the yield function. So if you were to dig into sleep on, which accepts a stall queue pointer, right now the ready queue is just a stall queue, although that's got to change. But what you'll discover is that the effect of this is to put you on a queue and call yield. Actually, more precisely, it is to put you on a queue and call sched abandon transaction. Now, I haven't talked about these, but this is, I recall talking about these. Remember I said this is a transactional kernel, right? There are three ways that a transaction ends in this kernel, right? The first is success. That's a good way to end. I like it. You know, you get that great. I'm all for it. Okay. The other two are you can call sched abandon transaction, or you can call sched restart transaction. What's the difference? Restart is the case where you want to back out, you want to start over, but you do want to start over right now. You've hit some condition that maybe ran you into a corner, but now that you fixed it, if you were to back up, things would be okay, except that you have to back up because now that you fixed it, you're going to end up going down a different path. So in this case, what happens is the stack is abandoned, process is pushed back to the outer edge of the kernel, just inside the edge, like just under the skin. Okay? The flow of control falls back into the scheduler. The scheduler says, I have a current process, and the current process is eligible to run. Good. I can choose a current process with no work. And I will now dispatch that process again, which is the same process we ran before. Right? We've only done the scheduling operation in the most trivial sense. Now that process will then be redispatched, it will re-execute the same system call that it did before, and presumably it will redo whatever it did, although that's not guaranteed. Other way that you could abandon is you could call sched abandon transaction. Now this one is saying, I'm not going to complete the transaction in process, I do not wish to try again right now, but I did this. Well, perhaps I have requested an I/O operation and I'm waiting for it to complete. There's no point running me anymore. I'll just ask for it again. Or perhaps I have been preempted and I have put myself on the ready queue and it is now appropriate to go and take the new best process, which might turn out to be me, but probably won't be me, from the ready queue. So the major difference between these two is that the per CPU notion of the current, okay, there's a field which is not currently in the CPU structure, but it will be by the end of today. It's currently a global, which says, what is the process that is currently running on this CPU? Running means it really holds the CPU. So when you come off the ready queue and you get dispatched, the current pointer is made to point to your process structure. The primary difference between these two strategies for terminating a transaction is that the abandon froze the current part. And when you re-enter the scheduler, the first thing the scheduler does is says, well, do I need to find a new current thing to do? And it does that on the basis of whether the current pointer is zero. So what the mechanism of preemption is, the timer goes off, right? It says, okay, I've got to preempt the current CPU, and we'll mark the process on it to preempt itself, and I will let it continue. Well, what happened is we'll return from the interrupt, and on the way out of the kernel, we will notice, oh, this process has been marked to preempt itself. At that point, the process will stick itself on the back of the ready queue. This is all inside the kernel code. So when I say the process will do it, I don't mean the process has a choice. I mean we're making the process pay for its own delay. Stick itself back in the back of the ready queue, and having stuck itself in the back of the ready queue, it will abandon the current transaction. Okay? And the reason it will abandon is to get the current pointer cleared, and then it will basically call the, that will cause the scheduler to be called, and the scheduler will now pick somebody else to run, which will probably be somebody else, and with very low likelihood might be this same process. Low likelihood, there's always somebody else to run. So the answer to your question is a little subtle, because of, and the reason I talked about yield, so the bottom thing, if you look at these two procedures, which I believe are in Kern's sched.c, you'll see that the last thing they call is something like low-level yield. And if you dig around, you will discover that ain't C code. Low-level yield hand resets the stack pointer and branches to a well-known kernel entry point. It abandons everything cold with no cleanup. So when I say you don't get to back out and undo your stack frames, I mean, we're not even going to look at them. We're going to throw them out. Okay, now, there's a catch. Right? This process just gave up the CPU one way or another. So if it had been asked to get out of the way, it has done so. You weren't really blocked on the CPU, you were blocked on the process operation that was then in progress, which is now in. So part of what will happen when the scheduler picks a new CPU, picks a new process, is it will clear the should defer flag. But it will also, both of these operations have the effect of incrementing the current transaction ID as well. What happens in that mutex try grab? What happens when the other guy's transaction ID gets bumped? What happens to the lock? It is implicitly released by the inequality of the transaction ID. Right? So we have just in fact deferred. That's the implementation of the defer. Okay. I think strictly speaking, should defer can safely be cleared whenever that transaction ID is bumped. That should be, that may be a bug in the current code I haven't looked at. Okay, so does that answer your question? This is tricky in itself. And by the way, in general, the notion of how a process gets bound to a physical CPU in order to run instructions, right, is one of these very hard to understand points of binding in operating systems. You'll hear people talk about the notion that every process has an associated virtual CPU, and that what happens really is that the virtual CPUs get bound to the CPUs. Now, if you went looking for the code for the virtual CPU, you wouldn't find any. This is a mental trick for understanding what's going on. It's a mental trick that I personally don't care for. Actually, it's better to just force your head through what's going on in this process, but it's a preference issue. Okay, so now there is a design assumption being made in this kernel that mutexes are the right data structure to use for everything. The only places where we use spin locks are in interrupt management, really. Right? Yeah. So the answer is that it applies to both the process and the CPU, but in the very act of descheduling itself. So the question is, what if the process switches in the middle? What does that mean? And the answer is, the act of switching the process already will have cleared the impediment by virtue of incrementing the transaction ID. And at that moment, the should defer flag can be cleared because it no longer applies. Can I answer your question?
Actually, is an extension.
Okay.
You are, sorry, what was it? It's a combination of CPU and processor. So basically, what I'm saying is if you associate the should defer flag with the CPU, and so let's say I'm am P3 and I'm waiting for some resource from process P2. I set shoulddefer flag for the CPU. Assuming
for
that
P2's CPU.
Okay.
If I'm P1, I'm on some CPU. Just to keep it simple, let me associate the CPU numbers with the process numbers, but there's no necessary relationship. So P1 is on CPU1, P2 is on CPU2.
Okay.
P1 is blocked for P2 to get out of the way, and P2 ought to get out of the way. Okay? The mechanism is that the code that P1 is executing, and that code is executing on CPU1, reaches over and marks CPU2 to say, defer. Okay. P2, executing code on CPU2, one way or another will either finish or notice, and it will get out of the way. So the tricky part here is that logically, it is P2 that is executing that code on CPU2. But mechanically, CPU2 is executing the code on CPU2, and this is actually a place where these two things both have to be dealt with together at the same time. It's not merely an abstract execution of code, it's a real execution of code, and we in some sense need to get both, our goal is to get both the logical thread of control and the actual thread of control, both of them out of the way. You're saying okay, but you're still sounding confused.
Yes, we assume that now we have even an P2 and P3 running on different CPU. Say that when I set shoulddefer flag on the other CPU, I'm assuming that the process which holds that resource is running right now on that CPU.
No. If that process is not running on that CPU, then we could not be blocked on that process and we would not have set shoulddefer on that CPU.
Okay.
Any state in which that process gets off the CPU, it will bump its transaction count. That frees the lock. And now the shoulddefer consideration ends. I asked somebody to close that door because
a helpful lawnmower.
Okay. So does that help? Okay.
Transaction IDs are part of the CPU, or are they a kernel level?
They're per CPU.
Okay.
Okay. That's actually a subtle point. If we were running this on a uniprocessor, right, we could tell a very nice story because, you know, the system calls go through one at a time, each of them finishes or it doesn't, but at the end, if we were going to try to take like a global view of what happened, we could line up the system calls and say, here's who did what in what order. A multiprocessor system, you generally cannot do that. And the reason is that there is some interleaving of activity. It all has the right outcome semantically, but unfortunately, you can't always linearize the answer when it's over. So in this case, the answer is the transaction IDs are per CPU. There were designs in which we attempted to come up with a way to linearize those things globally. In particular, there's a kind of locking that's a sort of an unusual case where I need a resource, I don't need it explicitly, I need to make sure of two things. One, it's got to remain in memory for the duration of my operation. Two, I probably don't want it to be modified. If I'm going to modify it, I need an exclusive relationship with it, at least while I'm modifying. So you arrive here at the temptation that you might consider multiple reader, one writer locks. These are one of the widely touted features of Solaris, that they did a lot of this kind of locking. There are numerous problems with multiple reader one writer locks. There is no known mechanism for avoiding priority inversion in a multiple reader lock. The Solaris kernel engineers allege that they have one, they do not. They have one that catches most cases, but it has some corner cases. The larger problem is that these locks are complicated. They require some kind of a queue. And the argument for why you need them is that you're going to be pinning down these resources long enough that allowing multiple simultaneous readers is worthwhile. And the context in which these locks are helpful is when you observe lots of reader-reader contention, but very little reader-writer contention, or writer-writer contention. So these are read-intensive objects. This dovetails nicely with the question I was about to ask. So let me put this thread just on hold for a second. And I'm going to go back to the question that prompted all this, right? So why is it that we chose to use mutexes and not semaphores or some data structure that would have associated a queue with the mutex? Private storage costs, right? Queues are expensive. They cost two extra words in some data structures that we're trying to keep small. But that was not the motivation. There are ways to solve that. Why not do semaphores? The question is, do we want to put in a queue? The question is, what's the argument that we don't? It's true that we don't have long busy waits, but that actually doesn't steer us in either direction with respect to this question. The question is, why did we choose not to put in semaphores anywhere and use only mutexes, which always do busy wait? Right? There's no mechanism. If you have a resource and I need it, there is no way for me to get off the CPU until you let go. The architecture of the design of this kernel, the implementation of this kernel, says, if you hold the resource and I need it, I am going to tie up my CPU until you get out of the way.
You have an assumption that since the wait is not long, it's okay rather than putting the process.
Is this essentially what you were trying to say as well? Okay, then I misunderstood what you were trying to say, and that's half the story. You're right. So, look, the argument is, if all of the path links are short enough, by the time I can get you off the CPU and get something else scheduled, the resource is going to be free, and then I'm just going to be doing it again. The only reason to put you on a queue is if I think the resource is going to be held long enough for something else to run productively. There's a cost to switching processes. That has to be traded off against the cost of wasting CPU time having you spin. Those decisions can only be determined by measurement in real systems. In microkernels, the arguments in principle about why this is a more plausible design are pretty clear, but even so, you still have to measure because reality is often surprising. You may have noticed this. But there's another argument. Under what conditions would I ever see anybody actually in the queue on a semaphore? What has to happen to get somebody in that queue? That certainly might cause it to happen, but generically, what has to happen to get somebody into that queue? And let me encourage you now not to think about I/O resources. We actually will enqueue people for I/O resources. That's not the kind of locking we're looking at here. We're looking here at locking for in-memory resources. Set?
When you sleep.
Well, no, I'm going to go to sleep as a actually, I'm going to yield as a consequence of going on the queue. But the question is, why would I have gone on the queue in the first place? It's about everything relates to the productivity of the process. Look, what had to happen, I mean, the first thing, in order for me to end up on the queue at all, resource had to be in use, right? If it weren't, I would have gotten it. And we just said, if I'm going to admit a design in which I'm going to queue, my belief is that that resource is going to be held long enough that I can productively context switch. The context switches are measured in thousands of cycles. And if we're talking about an in-memory resource, you know, there are very few operations that take thousands of cycles. It has to be an operation on a shared resource that is in-memory that's going to take a long time. I've managed to get a bunch of people backed up on it. What does that tell you? Look, if this happens once in a blue moon, I don't care. In fact, if it happens once in a blue moon, I don't care if I waste the CPU. So why do I need the queue? Not only do I have to argue that it is productive to context switch, I have to argue that it's going to happen often enough to give a damn. So what's going on in this case? What's happening here? This resource is so important that a lot of people are trying to get it at the same time, right? And there's a higher level design problem. What has happened is I have exceeded, I've put more processors into the system the feasible concurrency of the system allows. So if you believe that you can successfully design a system in which all paths are short, the presence of a semaphore is a confirmation of an architectural flaw. Because you wouldn't have put it there if you didn't have a bottleneck. And the only way you can get a bottleneck is if your hold times are too long or your degree of concurrency is too high for the data structures. And there are good solutions to both of those problems, but neither of them involves sticking a queue in the mess. Look at your hold times and relook at your architecture. Don't obfuscate the problem. That, I promise you, will not help. Right? All that will do is guarantee that of your 15 processors, you're only actually using the number that can naturally flow through. You might as well turn the other processors off. You are not getting any yield out of them. They're doing a wonderful job heating your room, but that's all you're accomplishing with them. You want this? Okay. Reasonable to say processors should spend a low percentage of the time in kernel. Is it better to be a Catholic or a Protestant? It's a question like that. There's some assumptions we have to unpack, because the problem is if you ask four kernel designers this question, you'll get eight opinions, and then they'll start arguing. Right? And the problem is it depends on what assumptions you're coming from. If your view is that the job of the kernel is to provide service to the application, then you might take the view, well, running in the kernel is doing useful, productive work that I asked for, and it takes however long it takes, and as long as I'm not stepping on myself managing the concurrency, that's just fine. If you take the view that the kernel is a communication substrate that does a very little bit of coordination and protection, and that your sort of your services should be implemented outside the kernel, right, then the argument is, well, no, you should be looking for as low a kernel time as you can get. And the reality is in the middle, because there is a kind of benefit that even the microkernel is providing that is often ignored in this discussion. It's providing a benefit of implicit coordination. I send the file server a message, you send the file server a message, she sends the file server a message, right? These messages get delivered in some order. That order imposes an ordering on control flow. That ordering on control flow often results in simplified choices in how to implement the file server. So now I have to ask, well, are we going to count time when you were blocked because you couldn't make immediate progress, which in some sense is time in the kernel? Am I going to count that time against you? Now we're doing philosophy. Okay, because when you come off of that, you're going to start over in a microkernel, you're going to start over in an atomic kernel, or you're going to proceed forward in a non-atomic kernel. And again, it's a question of, in principle, should you have accumulated any resource that you're productively carrying? So you see, this is very tied up in your philosophy of system design. Kyotos, the goal is low kernel overhead. However, there's another factor. One of the things that happens as you look at system structure, you see two trends in system structure. Both of them have principled arguments. One of them is rarely actually driven by the principled argument. The more common trend is the push for monolith. Okay? It's a shove everything you can into one blob of code and hope you get it right. This, in practice, is almost always driven by short-term considerations of cost. What's fast, not what's right. What's right takes a little more upfront time. And it almost universally neglects long-term considerations of cost, because the result of that over time is you throw the system away. I had a discussion with somebody at Lockheed late last week who said, was talking about a replacement cost problem, and comes up with a statement, we have $1 billion worth of code that we have to move, and if you're going to propose a new system, there's no way we can change all that code. Now here's what I can tell you if you have $1 billion worth of code. First, you don't have $1 billion worth of code, because the depreciation schedule on code is only 18 to 24 months. So you actually have $0 worth of code, but let's ignore that. Right? This is called sunk cost. Okay. If you have $1 billion worth of code, the question is, what is that a measure of, cost or value? Okay? And it's always a measure of cost, and it's always a measure of sunk cost. Sunk cost means money you already wasted. Now, the value of that code, if you're really, really lucky, it's about 5% of what you invested in it. And I happen to know a few other numbers about the cost structure of that organization that suggest that the value of that code may be a great deal lower than that 5%, because I know how much they're spending to document it after the fact. The number that was batted around was $2,200 per 100 lines of code in documentation costs. In defense of them, right, they have a problem. They have a body of code that was written by people who are now largely retiring. This code has stayed in use because nobody really understands how it works. It was not well documented. It's working well enough that nobody dares fix it. And it runs unimportant things like nuclear missiles, submarines, reactors. I mean, there might be good reasons not to risk bug injection in this kind of code. But, you know, measurements of value are very tricky in these businesses. And what that documentation process is paying for is essentially knowledge capture before the people who built the code retired. And that's a reasonable thing to capture. What they have, in some sense, is unrealized value in the code, or uncapitalizable value in the code, and they're trying to make that value capitalizable value. Code is very expensive to build when you actually figure out all of the cost that people sweep under the rug. Okay, let me finish the diatribe, and then let me come back and answer that. So there's a point to this, right? So what's the other way to build code? The other way to build code is to be obsessive about factoring and refactoring and keeping your systems clean so that the purpose of each subsystem is sort of well-defined and reasonably well separated from the purposes of other systems. This gets you code that's maintainable and more checkable and probably more robust, but the cost of it is you're going to take more communication overhead having one piece of code communicate with the other. The principal argument for Monolith is, hey, communication has cost. And monolithic designs often allow you to avoid data motion. Data motion is where all of the cost in modern computing goes. The problem with this argument is you can avoid that data motion in a decomposed design as well. People just don't think it through. Okay, so would it be credible to say I'll just implement a grand kernel lock and I'll only allow one process in the kernel at a time, and life will certainly be much simpler if I do that? Yes, as long as you don't want to run more than two processors on any real machine. Because, unfortunately, it's not the case that you ever get to vanishingly low utilization of the kernel. What you actually see is that the given CPU will spend about 30 to 40% of its time in supervisor mode, whether or not it's a microkernel. The interesting thing is that number does not impact overall productivity. Like there is no measured overhead. There's an argument in a research paper that says microkernels have fundamental performance overheads that are inescapable. It's a great paper. The measurements are wrong. They measured one system and they drew a sweeping conclusion about a class of systems. In a fairly insulting sweeping conclusion, it's completely wrong. And in fact, if you simply rearrange their numbers, their own measurements, it's very apparent that the result is wrong. In fact, if you look at measurements on other systems, what you discover is, yes, you pay a little more in total kernel overhead. You tend to get it back in user-level structuring. This is a very subtle issue. If there's a delta, it's not obvious which way it goes, and it's small. So in answer to your question, I would say, no, it's not likely that the single kernel lock is going to help. Now, why do we believe in Kyoto is that we're not likely to see the multiple readers issue? The answer is, the place in this kind of an architecture, you're not going to see multiple reader issues on processes. Either I'm running or I'm not. If I'm running, I'm doing all the accesses to me. You're going to see a multiple reader issue that matters on endpoints because only one of those can be allowed to go through anyway. So if one of them queues behind the other, you've actually just solved the queuing problem that you would otherwise have to deal with later. You're not going to see a multiple reader issue on data pages because the overwhelming majority of the data page accesses are going to go through load and store instructions. We won't be looking at locking for those cases. You might, in principle, see it for capability pages, but the use patterns that we're seeing don't seem to suggest that that's likely. The place where you would expect to see it is in the GPT structures because you might see processes sharing address spaces. It turns out that those address spaces get pulled into page tables, and so the multiple reader contention again gets resolved by load operations, in this case driven by the TLB, and those operations do not cause lock contention. The argument, and this has to be measured, this is an assertion, it is not a fact. The assertion is that there's really only one architectural place where high read concurrency seems likely, and the caching design has the effect of taking that place off the table for purposes of design considerations. So the argument is no matter which way you come at this elephant, right, you know the six or seven blind men and the elephant, right, no matter which part of the elephant you're trying to figure out what you're feeling, right, none of the answers are going to come out wanting to put cues in the picture. I've never actually seen a cue attached to an elephant, so this is probably a good thing. All right. Any other questions on the subject of locking design? Spin locks. So what about those IRQ locks? Why have them? The characteristic of a spin lock is something is going on that I really must respond to, and I must not back out. What would be an example of such an activity? An interrupt comes into the processor, and for a variety of reasons, it is possible for two processors to think that they are responding to this interrupt at the same time. One case that might arise, one process has done a shutdown operation on a device, and just as the shutdown operation enters the kernel, an interrupt comes in from the device, which gets delivered to a second processor. The second processor is trying to process the interrupt. You now have two CPUs going after the same device. However, the processor that took the interrupt, one of the things that it's probably grabbing a lock to do is to mark the fact that an interrupt is being serviced on this device, that there's an interrupt known to be pending. In order to mark that bit, as if we're going to shut the device down, we're going to mask interrupts, and we're not going to mark that bit. In order to mark that bit, there's a lock we have to grab, because we could have two CPUs acting on this at the same time. What happens if the guy who took the interrupt gets to the lock and fails to acquire it and backs off? What just happened? What's that? The interrupt got lost. Because in backing off, in failing to acquire the lock, we made the decision that we were not, as a consequence, going to update that bit. And of course, the interrupt will not come again. So we will not repeat the action later. Meanwhile, the second party who was trying to shut the device down may arrive at some circumstance in the middle in which they conclude they cannot shut the device down. They may then back out, leaving the device live. An interrupt that we miss on a device that's getting shut down anyway might not be so bad. There's no guarantee the device is actually going to get shut down. Another case of an interrupt that we better not lose is the printf lock. Right? You don't want to be interrupted in the middle of a printf, because how could this happen? Well, you call printf from normal kernel behavior, and the kernel takes an interrupt from inside the kernel, a second level interrupt. Interrupt handler calls printf, and now what you get is scrambled eggs. If what you're looking for is a New York Times word puzzle, this solution is for you. But if what you're looking for is readable diagnostics, this is not what you were after. I have opened the can of worms of second level interrupts.
Yeah, I was just excited
that you would. Oh, that helped me.
And then you wouldn't have an interrupt call.
What would happen if I disable interrupts? Running in the kernel, and I have interrupts turned off. So what did I just turn off that I might not have wanted to turn off? I turned off the timer, which means that while I'm in the kernel, you cannot be preempted. Right now, the user might view that as a feature. But what will happen in that case, the timer will go off, right? The hardware will assert its interrupt, the processor will refuse to accept it, then execute to the end of whatever path we're in the kernel. In the middle of this, by the way, we may, for other reasons, have picked a new process. We will then go to dispatch that new process to user land. Now, on the way out to user land, we will re-enable interrupts or we will be in deep trouble. And that process will make it to the wall of user land, and they will get to peer over the fence, and the interrupt will go, "No, you can't climb over the fence, you're coming back down into the kernel." And the process is like, "But I didn't do anything, it was my turn, really, really." The interrupt hardware is saying, "Yeah, come with me, kid. We're going downtown to the scheduler. You're gonna get booked." Now, there's actually nothing wrong with this scenario if the interrupt was actually going to that process, but notice that we've just done the entire cost of a user exit and kernel reentry merely because we turned off the interrupt. Whereas, if we had allowed ourselves to simply take judicial notice that this interrupt had occurred and leave a memo to ourselves that we should deal with it before we exit the kernel, we could have avoided a multi-thousand cycle overhead. So the policy in the Kyotos kernel is it will allow exactly one level of nesting. So you can have an interrupt that takes you in from user land. While that interrupt is being serviced, you can take one more. The second level is taken. All we will do is mark a bit saying, this interrupt has been taken and we have to do something about it before we exit the kernel. We will immediately return from the second level handler. will not process the interrupt immediately, except perhaps to mask it out. Now, there's actually not much to process, since the kernel, all it's going to do in response to an interrupt is set some process running, right? So there isn't actually that much to do. Why not allow interrupts to nest arbitrarily? I inadvertently tested this recently. Why would I not want interrupts to nest arbitrarily? I'll give you a hint. Printf is an amazingly slow function. You think that writing to a display memory would be fast. You would be wrong. Why not allow interrupts to just nest?
Okay. In space of throwing.
Okay. Right. So remember, the interrupts are coming from a set of devices that, as an OS designer, I can tell you absolutely nothing about. I don't know what you're going to attach to that machine. I know some devices that are on it when it comes out of the factory, and I'm pretty sure those are there. As to the rest, I don't know. I don't know how fast these interrupts are coming. I don't know whether the devices are designed correctly. There are instances of devices that feel that one interrupt is not good enough, 1,000 would be better. Not that there's more to do, they just really want your attention. And the problem is, in the face of an interrupt storm, which is the term, I may not be able to keep up. If I fail to keep up, what's going to happen to my stack? Grow. And when it grows far enough, what's going to happen? I'm going to start occupying space that I might have preferred to be using for something else. In fact, that I was using for something else. Day zero, I said, the kernel is the place where the rubber actually meets the road, and it really doesn't care if your toe happens to be at the point of attachment or of meaning, right? The stack is like that. One of the things you have to know in a kernel is that you can establish a bound on the total depth of the stack. If you can't do that, you don't know if your kernel runs. And in development kernels, this doesn't help you for a high robustness system in production, but in development kernels, it's very common to see whatever stack size I think it will be, I'm going to add one more page, and that page, I'm going to make it be invalid at all times so that I will catch the fact that the stack has run off the end of the train. And I will take a page fault. On the Pentium, this is a little tricky because what happens when you take this page fault is it attempts to write to the stack. And, you know, we've already run out of turtles or we wouldn't be in this situation. You really need to bound the number of simultaneous interrupts. And the choice in Kyotos is that we will take one primary and then we will take note of a secondary. Now, that's not strictly true. There's one other case. It's actually possible for us to hit a depth of 3. And the case in which we can hit a depth of 3 is you invoke a system call. Somewhere in the middle of accessing your data, we take a page fault referencing your data. So that's 2. And somewhere in the middle of the page fault, your preemption timer goes off, and that's 3. Some other interrupt goes off. There is a hard bound. The reason, by the way, that invalid page doesn't help on a high robustness system, right? There is no recovery when you run out of stack. The only thing you can do at this point is reboot the system, and we have just failed Scott's altitude metric for system robustness. Remember the altitude metric? It's how many thousand feet the plane falls before you recover. So you really have to solve this problem by prior design, and that faulting page is a development sanity check. Because this is one of these things where wearing both a belt and a set of suspenders is sometimes a good idea. The consequences of having your pants fall down in public are often embarrassing. Never actually tested this.
Whatever that interrupts can be.
I mean, what's the deal with that?
Why is that one that occurs to?
Okay. What would happen if I shoved all of this? So the question is, why do we want to distribute interrupts across CPUs? Good question. And the answer in some cases might be we don't. And the answer in other cases might be maybe we want to build a partition. All the networking interfaces will go here. Okay. Why do we want to, let's start with just, I want to distribute them across all the CPUs. Why would I want to do that? What?
Sharing the load.
Why would I want to split the load?
I used to use the processors.
Well, of course, if I'm not interrupting the processors, they're getting work done. So, right, that would argue that rather than penalize all of my processors, I should really just slap around one of them. Seen the t-shirt, right? The flogging will continue until performance improves. Every one of these interrupts is flogging the processor. I have 2 processors. It probably actually doesn't matter. Because if I'm not keeping up with the interrupts on one, I'm probably not going to keep up with the interrupts on 2. And for that matter, if I have enough interrupts that I even have to ask the question on a two-processor system, I may have bigger problems. Well, all interrupts take the same amount of time to process. Processing doesn't mean, yes, hardware, I saw the interrupt. Processing means I did something about it. We're not really interested in the delay from the wire going active high to the time we say, ah, yes, that was an interrupt. We're not done yet. We're interested in the delay from the time the wire goes high to the time that we can usefully say that we have serviced whatever activity that wire was asking us to service. And that might be an interrupt that says, the output FIFO on the serial line is dry. It's empty. To which the answer is, cool, good. I'm happy. Thanks for telling me. And it might be, there's a 4,000 byte packet coming in on the gigabit network, and there's about 15 more behind it. Come do something about it. Which is going to take me rather longer, because I'm going to have to run substantial parts of the TCP IP stack to figure out what the hell to do with them. So why do I want to distribute the interrupts? Basically, if I have one that takes a long, I'm repeating partly because when people are talking from the classroom, the recorder doesn't get it. So the idea is if I have one that takes a long time, I can at least deal with others. What would happen if I didn't? So instead, I say, let's explore the possibility. I'll flog the one processor. I'll put them all on the one processor. Now what?
Sir, until it dispatches, that happens.
Okay, so the answer I'm looking for is if I force all the interrupts to one processor, what's going to happen is they're going to boxcar. The minute I get a long-running interrupt, what's going to happen is all the other interrupts are going to queue behind it. And once they get into this queued state, it's pretty easy for them to stay that way. That's the classic argument. And so the argument goes, initial argument goes, distribute the interrupts, at least in a tightly coupled processing system. Distribute the interrupts across all the processors. In a loosely coupled system, you would say, let me try to get the interrupts to the processor that's closest to the source of the interrupt, or reasonably close. Because there's no point getting an interrupt from one side of the room and trying to process it from the other side of the room using tin cans and string as my means of communication, which is basically what you connect NUMA processor elements with. You ever seen a string inside a large-scale NUMA processor? I'll open one up. See if I'm not telling the truth. And it's a very expensive string. There's a middle position which lately has been explored in the networking community which says there's another effect to consider, and the other effect is caching. And it's caching in the TLB and in the code and data caches. The argument goes, you may have a very high frequency source of interrupts, like a network. There are major advantages if you can say, look, if that processor just handled a network interrupt, hit it again, because the code that it needs is almost certainly still in the cache. And I can get a sort of a something like a pipelining advantage if I can keep all the network-related work over there. There have been experimental designs in high-speed networking where you basically dedicate a victim for all the networking interrupts, and then you spread the remaining interrupts over the non-networking processors. And you could see a similar story for other kinds of high-speed interfaces. This is an interesting architecture problem. This story is completely wrong. The historical reason for distributing interrupts was the assumption the interrupt handler was going to run in the kernel. If the interrupt handler runs in the kernel, it has a way of being non-preemptible. And if it is not preemptible, you will indeed get all of these boxcar effects that we've been talking about. This has nothing to do with what happens in a microkernel. In a microkernel, what happens is the kernel notices the interrupt. The total effect in the kernel is to schedule a process to run. What's happened is that previously a driver has said, release me when interrupt 5 happens. The total action of the kernel is to release that process. Then that process runs according to the dictates of the scheduler, just like any other process in the system. And because it is not in the kernel, it is in fact preemptible. There probably is not a credible story as a result. One interrupt will necessarily cause boxcars of other interrupts. Did that, it's because you made a bad scheduling policy decision. The answer is fix the scheduling policy. The drivers are preemptible. There is still an important argument about CPU affinity. You want to get the interrupt processed on the CPU where access to the data is likely to be efficient. One of the things that this forces you to expose in the scheduler design, and something we have not yet exposed in Coyotes, is some mechanism for saying, I have a process, and it doesn't want to run on just any processor. It wants to run on this particular set of processors, one of these candidate processors. Not all CPUs are equal with respect to the requirements of this process. And this is mostly not important in the kinds of multiprocessor desktop systems that you're looking at right now, or even most server systems. But as you move up the food chain to these systems that have non-uniform memory access, one CPU's access to this page can be real fast, and another one's could be relatively slow, and that relatively could be 2 decimal orders of magnitude. All of a sudden, localization of effort matters. And you find yourself wanting to move the computation to the data, and this turns into a binding decision that has to be expressed, right? What you really want to say now is, well, this process should be a candidate to run at the following priority between the following windows of time, but only on those CPUs over there. And by the way, if you're looking for a PhD topic, problem of scheduling when the pool of resource is non-uniform in this way. Like in general, the problem of really good multiprocessor scheduling, real-time scheduling, is an open problem in the literature. There is a little bit of work on it in the job shop scheduling literature. And much of that applies to the processor scheduling literature, but not in obvious ways, and there are other concerns in processors. So we're still having fun on interrupts, right? Interrupts are tricky. And you can start to see here that this philosophical issue, was I going to build a really small kernel and push everything out, or was I going to build a monolithic kernel and pull everything in? We've already seen a bunch of places where this early decision has had consequences in other decisions or other outcomes in the architecture, right? It's a very polarizing decision. Because once you make that initial decision to build a small kernel and push the work out, other decisions come out of that that progressively move you in one architectural direction or another. One of the problems with performance comparison in these systems is they aren't both apples, so it's very hard to do apples and apples comparisons. Let me make a final point about interrupts in monolithic systems. I said in monolithic systems that interrupts are generally not preemptible. Now, this is not strictly true. If you go and look at the BSD kernel, you will see that the BSD kernel imposes a notion of interrupt priorities. And some interrupts are known to be really short, and they will be allowed to preempt other interrupts. You have to have some prioritization scheme to guarantee a limit on stack depth. By and large, they're certainly not as preemptible as application-level interrupts. I'm running some code, right? And we've established that in principle, if we had a microkernel design, and in the monolithic system we don't, but if we did, we could run this code at application level. Now, what priority do you imagine I would run the TCP stack at in comparison to your word processor? Would the word processor run with higher priority, that is, more urgently, or would the TCP stack run more urgently? And you guys are starting to spot a trick question when it comes, aren't you? As usual, I can go either way on this one. What do you think? Come on, take a flyer. Which one? What's that?
TCP
higher priority, more likely to be used by more things. It's a plausible story, particularly if I'm doing a high-performance network. 100 megabits is not a problem. Gigabit actually requires some thought to process efficiently. So it's a plausible story. It's not the traditional story. Did you have a different answer in the back?
Well, I mean, there is a story that goes something along the lines of the human user is currently physically interacting more with the word processor, and we want it to be responsive to them. Although I think you could make a good case that Microsoft Word will never be responsive because it's a giant behemoth, and so you might as well not bother.
I'm not sure if the non-responsiveness of Microsoft Word has any relationship to the human being in the loop at all. But let's leave that aside. Okay, how many of you have ever spent some time playing with a stopwatch? Maybe you were standing in a pool, and there was a swim meet going on, and there was a spare stopwatch, and you were playing with a stopwatch. Right? Now, anybody who plays with a stopwatch will try to see how fast can you hit the stopwatch twice. Right? Anybody tried that? How fast can you go? Do you happen to remember what the number was? Okay. Scott?
Half a second.
About half a second?
Well, it's not really.
You're pathetic. Okay. Somebody else up here had done this. How fast did you go?
I think it was like 14 milliseconds.
14 milliseconds. Okay. So, I'm not going to sound like a bragger, but I will explain that there's no bragging in this because I have to explain how it works. I actually can hit a stopwatch twice in a millisecond or less. There's no brain processing between those two clicks. It's all happening in the lower nervous system. Both signals have been sent before either one is processed. And your lower nervous system actually does work that way. And if you stand there and practice double-clicking the stopwatch, you actually can get there. And by the way, there is no economic payoff in this activity at all. You're really, really bored. Now, if you actually want to see the stopwatch start and then click it again, 14 milliseconds is probably a human performance floor. I mean, if the challenge is, can I get it to stop at 001? Good. Now, how long is 14 milliseconds relative to a CPU that executes in gigahertz? Does the word forever resonate? It's forever. That is orders of magnitude more instructions than a process will typically run between page faults. Give me 14 milliseconds, I can take over the world before I process your next keystroke. I mean, it helps to be Bill Gates because you have a large starting advantage, but okay. And the argument goes, you know, the beautiful thing about word processors is in spite of how it looks to you, they don't actually do any work. You type a key. The word processor goes off and it runs a couple hundred thousand instructions. This takes like no time at all. And it updates the display. And for the next 13 and a half milliseconds, we're going to be waiting for you to do another keystroke. So the idea goes, we should run the word processor at really high priority. Heck, it ain't going to do anything anyway. But in fact, as a human user, right, you would like to see it not do anything quickly. Even better argument for the audio player, because it turns out human ears do notice delay in audio playing much more than they do in video. I mean, it's very intolerant of audio delay. A 10 millisecond audio gap is a big deal. A 2 millisecond audio gap is noticeable to a trained listener. And if you want to test this, come by my house and I will reestablish the old audio studio configuration I had, where I had two FireWire devices on different channels and they didn't quite sync up and they had 10 millisecond delays, and the experience is actively painful. And you do not have to be a recording engineer to appreciate the pain of it. You can hear the beat frequencies. There's an argument that says, give the word processor all the CPU it can eat, because it can't eat very much. And you aren't reading those packets anyway. The real answer is, I don't know what the right policy is. It depends on what problems you're trying to solve at the moment. I do know if you're not running the audio player, I probably don't want to give it high priority. If the movie is the fourth one back in your movie stack, you aren't watching. I don't really care how fast the frames update. What I do want to be able to do is speed it up very quickly when you bring that window to the front. This is, the tree is not falling in the forest. Until you look, and then, it fell a long time ago. Okay, so now let's investigate the story for a minute that we wanted to give high priority to the word processor. Well, in the monolithic scheme, when the network packet comes in, what happens? I think somebody pull a ripcord in the back. Right? The network card says, "Yo, I need your attention." And by the way, on modern network cards, there's typically something called a FIFO buffer on the network card. By the time your network card needs attention, it's already 10 packets into the ground and you're trying to dig it out. Typically, it's gotten a few more by the time you actually get there on a high-speed network. FIFO is the only thing saving your life on a modern, there's just a big imbalance between the data rates we can handle and the memories we can stuff them into right now. Very peculiar. Okay, so now the processor gets this interrupt. On a monolithic kernel, what happens next? Well, we just got an interrupt from the Ethernet driver. What's the likelihood we're going to go run the display code next? Will that help? I'm going to go run the Ethernet driver. The Ethernet driver is going to collect the packet, and it's going to reach over to the TCP IP stack and say, "Get off your lazy butt, I got a packet for you." The TCP IP stack, being equally friendly, has been saying, "Those packets are out of order. Call me back when they can get their act together and send them in some sensible way." But after a while, this will converge. Now, the packet came in the, you know, the picosecond after you typed the key on the keyboard. Notice we just ran off, you know, to Tahiti with the TCP IP stack. I assure you this will not appear in the New York Times. It's not interesting enough. What just happened to the priority scheme? It just gave de facto priority to the network stack. Right? And the policy we were investigating was, we would like to give de facto priority to interactive tasks. How did it come about that we gave priority to the network step? What happened? What screwed up the priority scheme?
Interrupts coming.
Sorry?
Order of interrupts coming.
Order of interrupts. Actually not. When you hit the keystroke, chances are very good that that read completed. We have delivered that keystroke to the application. Chances are very good. The application has arbitrarily high priority, because this is the word processor application, let's just imagine. How did it come about that even though we had this thing with arbitrarily high priority, we ran the networking stack anyway? Well, I mean, I could say, to hell with the packets, I'll let them fall on the floor and let the poor loser on the other side retransmit them. After all, if they can't take a joke, they shouldn't be sending me packets. Yes, so I got an interrupt and I concluded that it had to be serviced. And it was in the nature of the architecture that it was hard to defer servicing it. Part of the reason it was hard to defer servicing it is that I was running this activity in kernel mode. So notice what happened is that the interrupt subsystems are a de facto part of the scheduling priority system in a monolithic design. That's true because the associated processing happens in kernel mode, and it happens in a fashion that is not under the governance of the scheduler. In fact, what happens is that any interrupt has higher priority than any process. Any government is confused. It's in the nature of government. But if you want to make things really special, have two competing governments managing things at different layers of abstraction without talking to each other. Guaranteed to make your life an unending source of entertainment. What's happening here is we have scheduling happen at two levels of abstraction that are not collaborative. And the hardware layer, by the way, there isn't much you can do to change that part. You really do have to service the interrupt quickly. There is hardware that will just cease to operate if you don't respond quickly. So there is a need to respond to the hardware interrupt within a very sharply bounded amount of time to say, I got it. And there is a risk that response does not include draining the FIFO on the Ethernet part. There is a risk that if you fail to drain the Ethernet part quickly enough, you will lose some packets. Is that the end of the universe? That's in the packet. But if it is the end of the universe and you lost a packet, you have a systemic design problem. Screwing up your priority management won't help. On the contrary, getting all of your scheduling into a single framework where you can address the issue in a coherent, consistent way might give you a fighting chance. So one of the areas where monolithic kernels actually significantly fail is inconsistency of scheduling. And the worst part of it is a very large number of those packets are actually going to get thrown away because you're not ready for them. What do you think flow control is? Flow control is when your network card says, oh, I'm full. Stop feeding me. Well, guess what? At the time you say stop feeding me, the other card is still shoveling food at you as fast as it can go. Right? What happens is those dribble down your shirt. Okay? And sooner or later, the other guy says, hey, I noticed your shirt is dirty. You guys should stop. Sorry, I'm a near three-year-old. These images come to mind pretty readily. Your own codec moments will come in due course. So it's not the end of the world to lose those packets. In fact, if you knew what your capacity was, you might even successfully negotiate a rate. There's a rate. What happens when your TCP/IP stack is in the kernel and I send a denial of service attack at your network card? How much word processing do you get done? Any word processing done? Want to take a guess? None. Right? I can send so many packets at your Ethernet card that the only thing your processor will do is process the interrupts, throwing them away. You get maybe 5% of the CPU left for useful activity. Which is why, ultimately, the only technically feasible solutions to denial of service are going to involve telling the guy upstream of you to shut up, or maybe to filter. What would happen if those interrupts were handled just enough to say, go schedule the TCP/IP process? You still get any word processing done? You got in there on the first one, so you know, this is the price of being right the first time. Perhaps. You want to take a risk here? Would you like to buy a vowel? I think probably you'd get word processing done. Why?
Could be able to schedule it as a...
Yes. So I would be able to schedule it, and one effect of that is that I can put an upper bound on the total amount of CPU that it will consume, right? But of course, that means I'm not going to get to all those packets, which means they're going to flood the FIFO, because I'm not going to clear the FIFO fast enough. Because if I were clearing the FIFO fast enough, I would be spending 95% of the CPU with that activity, right? So what's going to happen to those packets? You're going to drop them on the floor, which is what you were going to do anyway. It's much cheaper to drop packets on the floor by not looking at them than by looking at them and throwing them away. So there is this problem with scheduling in interrupt systems, and at least this issue, microkernels clearly have some advantages. They also have disadvantages. There are interactions with hardware, brief interactions, where you want to say, between here and here, I better not get interrupted. I have to hit three registers on the hardware. I have to hit them in the right order within the right time frame. And that's difficult to do from user level, so there is a cost. But it's manageable. I'll give you another example of the same problem. The X window system has the following behavior, or at least it used to. The way this would work is my application does some graphics operations, and you got some fancy GUI library, right? Down at the bottom, there's this thing called xlib. And xlib's job is to assemble packets. And those packets go onto a network connection, and they come into the X server. And the X server has your connection, and my connection, and her connection, and his connection. Everybody's got a connection, right? And the packets go into a buffer. And then inside the X server, there's an agent that runs around all the buffers processing their requests. How do you suppose video consistently failed in early implementations of X Windows? Well, I should explain that in those early implementations, a lot of the traffic was bitmap traffic. Vector graphics was something people knew about, but was still coming into play. It would require hardware assist that would not appear until a little later. Effective. What does it require for video to be successful? I have to get the frames drawn at a particular rate. There's a variable element in how large the frames are because of decompression. Ignore that. I have to get them drawn in a particular order, in a particular rate, or the video looks like stuff you don't want to see. Because if you're trying to draw a frame, my process has done some kind of a filtering operation that takes a long time to execute. And the X window system's little scheduler is running my filter at the time you need to get a frame out. It happens to your frame. I lost. It's sure delayed. Now, there were two problems in there. One was that my filter operation was not preemptible. We could design those operations to all have a sort of a maximum unit where after that amount of time, you would know you'd get a preemption. If you know what the worst case is, you could start to manage the issue. Assume it was preemptible. What I have here is a high priority drawing operation in the sense that the success of the application ultimately requires that. Competing with a low priority drawing operation, the X server has no idea what the respective priorities are. And I could have these applications connect up and say, I'm really important. How many applications do you know that would voluntarily say, I'm not really important? Everybody's a legend in their own mind. So this is the same problem as the interrupt problem happening at a different level of abstraction. You have, in effect, two layers of scheduling going on, neither of which is able to collaborate with the other. This layering of scheduling is actually a very hard, deep-seated problem in system design, and I'm actually not aware of any really good solutions to it in general. But the rule of thumb is, you're faced with something like this where you have a bunch of things you have to do and you're trying to figure out what order to do them in, try really hard not to invent your own de facto scheduler, because whatever solution you use, and it may be the world's best solution, it will have impedance mismatches with the fundamental scheduler of the system. Scheduling is something that does not layer well. Thus, you can ultimately get all the layers to talk in the same ground terms. Let's take a break. Let us resume at 20 of 4.